This is the Anderson Business Advisors Podcast, the show for real estate investors, stock traders, and business owners. We help you keep more of what you earn and protect what you've built. Let's get started.
Somebody told you that wholesaling real estate is a safe activity and you don't have to worry about being sued? Well, that's all wrong. And in this video, I'm going to prove it by interviewing Greg Helbeck of Velocity Home Buyers, and we're going to be discussing some of those things that went awry in his business, which almost torpedoed his entire wholesaling operation before it really took off. All right, let's get started. All right, Greg, hey, thanks for joining us today. We've got a lot to unpack when it comes to wholesaling. So before we get started about the wholesaling and the topics I want to go into today, why don't you just introduce to everyone who you are, what you've been doing with Velocity Home Buyers, and explain to them, if they're not familiar with wholesaling, what that actually is.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for having me, Clint. I'm Greg Helbeck. I've been a full-time real estate investor now for almost a decade. I started when I was 20, back in my parents' basement. And so over those, you know, that 8 years now of doing this full-time, you know, I've been able to build up a business where we're doing, you know, 50 plus deals a year in the East Coast area in Delaware and New York and a little bit out here on the West Coast. So, you know, I've got a pretty decent sized business back there. And if people aren't familiar with wholesaling, that is our core business right now. That's about 70% of our transactions. It's the simple act of going out and marketing to sellers directly, mail, internet, whatever marketing channel you want, getting good deals. The key here is good deals under contract, and then choosing to assign your contract to an end buyer for an assignment fee versus actually buying that property, closing on it, and then either flipping it or renting it. So you're basically just flipping paper, right? And people get really attracted to wholesaling, Clint, when they're new, because it is perceived that you need no money and there's no risk. But when you actually do this business for a little while, you'll realize you do need some money to grow your business through mostly advertising. And there is risk, which we'll get into in a minute here on a deal that I almost got, you know, cleaned out on.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because a lot of people who teach courses on wholesaling, I mean, that is the big, you know, draw, right? Here's the whiff them. Yeah. You can come in, you can wholesale with, you don't have to have any money and you can start up this business. Yeah, that's pretty damn tough to try to start a business with no money, because as you stated, advertising is important and structuring. So exactly. You touched on the subject, and I want to delve into this because I think it's really important. There is a misconception amongst many wholesalers that, hey, all I'm doing is flipping paper. I have no risk in this deal because I've just tied up the property under contract. And, you know, your client and you've shared with me those issues that you've run into. So before we get into, like I talked about, the market and what you're doing right now and how things have changed, let's just talk about that risk. So why don't you share with some of the, with the audience, things that have happened on your wholesale deals. And then let's talk about what you did to get out of it and how you were structured, how it helped protect you.
For sure. So I'll start with a story and then I'll start to make the points through that story. So this was actually last summer in 2023. I was doing a wholesale deal with a buddy of mine, actually, and he brought me a house and he was new. And he's like, hey, listen, I got this deal. Why don't you use your LLC to put it into contract? And then, you know, you'll find the buyer. And then at the closing, you know, we'll do a JV agreement and we'll split it 50-50. And I do this all the time. I do this with new people all the time. You know, they come to me and I can help them with their, you know, deals and whatnot. So I'm like, sure, that sounds good. I ran the numbers. That made sense. It was actually a manufactured home out in the Hudson Valley, which is about an hour and a half from New York City. And I got it under contract, manufactured home on land. So it wasn't in a park. And I locked it up and I found a buyer, actually. And we got the buyer in contract. But while we were finding this buyer, Clint, we had multiple buyers who were going to see it, right? So this thing was vacant. The seller was actually a real estate agent that lived like way upstate, like in Rochester or something like that. So it was on a lockbox. There was a lockbox on the house. So the house was completely unoccupied. And while we were doing this, you know, when we found the actual buyer, you know, I think the buyer beforehand or something like that ended up going inside the property to take a look at it. And he turned the lights on and then he turned the lights off. And he went into one of the rooms. I forget. He went into one of the rooms. He left. So he didn't do any damage to the property. But after he left, the entire property caught fire and burned to the ground.
Damn.
And just like freak accident at this property. The whole thing burned down. The seller wasn't living near there. I live in Nevada. So I live out in Reno. So I'm obviously not there. I barely ever go there. It's where I'm from. And, you know, I was like, oh my God. And obviously the deal did not work out with the other buyer because he was not going to buy land, right? Wasn't going to buy land. And the seller was very upset. And, you know, I was kind of like, okay, like this is bad, but hope she has insurance. And, you know, I've seen this happen with other properties before, you know, landlord properties catch fire and whatnot. So basically I thought I was going to get out of this thing with zero repercussions at all. And I thought she was just going to take her out, and she inherited the property too. So like, it wasn't hers. She wasn't living there. It was like her family, I think her brother's property or something like that. So I'm thinking we're good. Hey, the deal died. You know, we got her. I actually got my deposit back initially because the property wasn't delivered the way it was promised. And then I ended up getting a letter. It was an email. I got an email from her attorney who she hired. And basically it was a pending lawsuit for punitive damages. And I was like, oh my goodness. I thought my only risk would have been the deposit. Turns out that wasn't the case. She was trying to sue my LLC, you know, for punitive damages in this situation, which is bad. If you're like a lawyer, like that's not good. That's dangerous and scary. And I had to, you know, investigate this whole thing. I called my closing attorney who doesn't do litigation. And I said, hey, and this guy's like very relaxed, like easygoing guy, doesn't really get nervous and scared when deals go bad. And I said, hey, John, am I in trouble here? Like, what is the deal? And he's like, dude, I'll tell you what. I saw this document and I was scared for you. And I said, oh my God. And he's like, normally, like, you know, we have deals with all the time with this guy. And he never gets worried. He's like, you're in trouble. He's like, you're in big trouble. And I said, holy smokes. Like, what am I going to do here? So long story short, I ended up hiring a litigation attorney and I had to get all the facts, you know, in line here to prove that I wasn't the reason the house burned down and it was a freak accident. So I took the fire report, called the fire department. I got all this stuff documented and I put it in a file. And then I had my litigation attorney send it over to their attorney to show them like he was not liable for this. It was an electrical fire. It was a freak thing. The house was vacant. And thank goodness, Clint, I was able to have all my ducks in a row and they ended up just walking away and they didn't actually go after me for what they wanted to go after me for because they didn't have a case. But I'll tell you what, if that wasn't the case, if there was a mistake I made and that buyer actually caused the fire and I was the one who allowed them in the property, I could have easily been sued for about $100,000. That was what my attorney was telling me initially. But because we had our ducks in a row, we didn't get hurt on that one. But that could have very well went the other way and could have been in a serious liability situation, which scared the heck out of me because before that, probably done 200 houses before that. Never was something like that. So it really woke me up, man.
Yeah, I always tell people that. They say, well, I've never been sued. I said, well, that's great that you've never been sued. But eventually, as you do more, that risk keeps going up and it may happen. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you still lost though, right? Because you had to pay an attorney to defend you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it wasn't. Yeah, I lost probably $3,000 at least. Yeah, no, it was about $3,000, a $6,000 retainer. Me and my buddy did it 50-50. So, yeah, it's like $3,000 L. And a lot of stress. It was a stress too. Like, I'm like, I couldn't sleep for the first couple of days. I was like,
you know, that's always the way it is the first time you're sued. Now, the way you structured that deal though, you did it through a business entity, correct?
Yes, my LLC.
So, all right. So walk people through how you put that deal together. And then let's talk about, you know, how you made sure that even if they were successful, you said $100,000, it wouldn't have cost you that, right?
Yeah. So the first thing I do when I get properties under contract is I never do it in my personal name, like ever. Mm-hmm. Like it's always through an LLC. This LLC is the one I use to flip and wholesale houses in. So like mostly wholesale actually. So like this LLC is basically just like an operating account. It has some cash in it and I make the offers through that LLC. Actually, after talking to you, I want to change my strategy up and get another LLC to make the offer in, which is a different topic for a different day.
Yeah.
But I knew when I was getting the initial kind of like garbage from the other attorney, I was like, okay, I was like assessing my situation here, you know, and figuring out what was going on. They were suing my LLC, or they were going to sue my LLC. Sorry, it was because this was an email. It wasn't a proper like serving of a lawsuit. And I said, okay, what does this LLC actually have? So I want to know, like, if whatever entity you're getting sued in, you want to know what does that have? Like, what are the assets under that LLC? And in this case, it was some cash in the bank. And the thing that scared me even more, Clint, was actually there was a flip I was doing about an hour away from there with a private lender in that actual LLC, Velocity House Buyers LLC. So the main thing I was concerned about was if they figured that I had that other flip going on and they wanted to try to use the equity in that flip to collect somehow, the lender was the main thing I was nervous about. Like, yeah, if I lost money, whatever, but the flip, I want that lender to get paid back with his interest because that's a personal relationship. This is a private lender. This isn't a hard money company. So I told John, my closing attorney, I said, John, if they are successful at this, could they basically get a judgment on my LLC that knows it has the flip going on within the matter of a month because I was selling that property? And he's like, dude, there's no way they'd be able to do that all within a month. Like, that would take much longer. There'd have to be discovery and this, that, and the other. So I knew my risks was that the LLC with a property that was getting flipped, that was in that LLC, and then the cash at hand. And that was basically it, because Greg Helbeck personally had no ties to that. It was just the LLC. And I have other LLCs with rental houses in them and whatnot. They would have really have no idea that was something I had either, because it's all separated. But if I had everything packed in one, if it's just Greg Helbeck personally, or, you know, Helbeck Holdings, which has flips and rentals, like, an attorney would see that and be like, oh, wow, this guy's got all this equity. He's got these properties. He's got cash. So, like, if you can limit what you put in each LLC, you know, it can just make it a little bit easier and less stressful, because, you know, most likely if they're going to just go after that LLC, you know what you have in there and you know what your risk could be, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So that's why, you know, we use strategies where, in your case, you know, you don't keep a lot of cash in that LLC because that's your deal making entity. And so correct. I tell, you know, we talk about this, do not hold assets where you conduct business. So you make some money, you pull it out, right?
Yes. Yes.
Now, about that property deal. So here's something that's, I think, a really great point for the people that are watching this right now. You never want to flip properties in your wholesaling entity, as you understand now. And that happens, right? You think you're going to wholesale, you end up closing on yourself and you're flipping it. You need to set up a different flipping entity because you got lucky. If I was advising that seller of that property, what I would have done is moved for a pre-judgment writ of attachment against your house and filed a Liz Pendens on it to prevent you from selling that property. In fact, that is actually what has happened to a client of mine here in Tacoma, Washington. He had three flips going on, and the attorney threatening lawsuit threatened to file a Liz Pendens. And he was in the same situation as you, two hard money lenders that he was working with, personal guarantees on these hard money loans, confessions of judgment, all of that. If they dropped the Liz Pendens on there, that thing would just roll right up on them personally. And so, yeah, there's a lot of risk there. You got lucky, obviously, because their seller's attorney didn't think about doing this. But what it could have done is force you to settle, because now they know, hey, we've got him because he wants to sell this deal. And if we're applying pressure, as HML is going to start applying pressure, he's going to buckle. So good on that. But yeah, asset protection, it's important we split those up. So tell me, what are some of the other, you know, just, you don't have to go really in depth, but some of the other things you've run across with your real estate that the viewers who are watching this right now that aren't appreciating the risk that comes from investing that have affected you?
Yeah. So I'll just give you a really straightforward one. I'm a landlord in New York State, which is one of the hardest places to evict, you know, when you need to evict. So I've had evictions that have taken 2 years. I've had to give tenants an unreasonable amount of money just to move, right, out of my properties. Those ones are bad. I've had many friends who've had a lot of, and New York is such an attorney friendly state, like with suing and whatnot, it's just like California where I used to live. I've had friends have slip and falls at their flips and get sued. I had another buddy, this is an interesting one. So normally when you're doing a deal, and this was in Connecticut, which is right next to New York, my one good friend, like some of my best friends in the business, they had a situation where they went into contract to buy something in Connecticut and they didn't read the contract correctly. And the liability on the buyer was not the earnest money getting defaulted. It was actually getting sued for the purchase price. So they ended up canceling this contract because there was an oil tank that was not disclosed. Yep. And they got sued for the entire purchase price and they had to settle for like $20,000. So, I mean, there's a lot of things, mostly Clint, around contract law with me that you need to know that I have, you know, like I said, thank God with the one on the firehouse, we had all the evidence to support the situation with me not being liable. But mostly eviction stuff, like long evictions and just like, you know, slip and falls with flips, you know, buyers coming back to you. Well, New York, this doesn't happen as much, but in Nevada and California, this happens more. If you don't disclose something on a flip and you don't do it the right way, you can get sued afterwards because, you know, there's a lot of, you know, it's kind of gray area with that. Like, oh, you didn't say this wasn't working. I'm going to sue you for 10 grand. And then you thought you sold the flip. And then all of a sudden you're getting sued for 10 grand. You got to settle for five. So thank goodness, actually, in New York, which I guess this is one of the hardest markets to wholesale in, which we'll get into. There's this thing you can do where if you don't want to fill out a seller disclosure form as the seller, you can give the buyer a $500 credit and then they take all the liability. So we do that obviously on every project. Yeah, it's crazy. So there's never, ever, ever after the fact any issues if you give them a $500 credit.
All that's just like buying an owner's policy or... when you sell the property, not an owner's policy, I forget what it's called, where you cover all the appliances and things like that.
Yeah, yeah, it's like a home warranty for $500. Yeah, home warranty. That's unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah. That is pretty cool.
It's the one good thing about New York, Clint. That's the one good thing that I agree with, where you just the $500 and go away.
Yeah, I know. I was approached last week. I got a call from a broker from California. And he's saying, hey, you know, I know you buy real estate and I've seen you on YouTube. I got this property, this commercial building, not commercial, a residential building coming up. It's got maybe 40 units in it. I just wondered if you'd be interested. I said, where'd you say it was? California? But Los Angeles? No, thank you.
No way.
He's like, why is that? And I said, you know, the politics of that state. I'm not going to get stuck in a property where I can't evict anybody and I have to give away free rent. No, not happening.
Well, did you just see the new law that's going on in Santa Monica? I just saw this last night where like basically you have to pay tenants like $18,000 to relocate or something in the city of Santa Monica per like, and that's for the studio. And then a one bed is like $25,000. I think it's a two bed. It's like $30,000 relocation fee.
Yeah. Well, that's just going to add to the problem. See, they passed this garbage. And if I own property down there, I would convert it all into condos. Just start going back into the condo conversions. In fact, I should cut a video on doing condo conversions. And how to structure those again, because they're going to come back into play. Because why rent and take on that liability? Just sell it and you'll just increase more of the housing problems they have because of stupid laws like that.
Yeah, it's crazy. But that's why I don't own property in California as a landlord.
Exactly. Stay out of the blue states is what I say, or the cities.
Yeah.
The cities. All right. I know people want to hear about your wholesaling as well. So now I want to transition into your business because you've done a ton of deals and you're actively there. And what's even more interesting is that you live in Nevada and you're wholesaling all the way across the country.
Yeah.
So how about we first talk about how are you able to wholesale in New York and Missouri and those other markets you're in when you live in Nevada?
Yeah. Great question. People ask me that a lot. So the main thing I will tell you is that I am originally from New York. So I grew up there. I started the business when I used to live there. This was back in like 2017. So I have a very good infrastructure set up there with contractors, buyers, boots on the ground that can go see properties for me, attorneys. So I have a great infrastructure set up there. So with my phone, I can make calls whenever I need to and have people go to properties for me. I have people who work for me full-time on my team. They can deal with all the sellers. So anytime I look at the business in terms of like, I want to do it virtually and not have to go there, because I know you live in Washington and you invest out of state as well for the most part. I look at what are all the bottlenecks that could be an issue by doing this virtually and how do I solve each bottleneck? So an example would be like, you know, contractors, right? How do we fix that problem? Well, even if I lived in New York, Clint, I probably wouldn't go to my projects because I absolutely can't stand going to see houses. I hate it. It's a time suck. I just can't stand doing it. I don't like driving there, driving back. It's just not a great use of time at this point. Like when I started, it was different. So if we're doing flips or if we're doing wholesales, we send the buyers to the property. Obviously, we're under contract with a binding agreement. So the buyers can't circumvent us because we have all the paperwork in place to avoid that. So that's pretty much how we like actually sell the properties in terms of disposition. We'll get the property under contract with the seller virtually, sign a DocuSign, have the attorneys involved. And then now I'm not there and my acquisitions guy actually lives in Delaware. So he doesn't live there either. He's ironically from New York. So we get a house in contract, we have a binding agreement, deposit in there. And then when we go sell those deals virtually now, if it's a vacant house, it's a vacant house, you know, there's access, there's a lockbox. They have to let us know when they're going, take a picture before, take a picture when they leave, so we know they lock the house up. But if the owner's living there, or if the owner's living in the house and, you know, we need to have buyers go in there, we'll literally send the buyer there to meet the seller. And thankfully, because I've been doing this for so long, all the buyers know who I am. I have relationships with these people. So, I mean, 99 out of 100 times, they're never going to try to snake me out of a deal or talk to the seller and be like, oh, this guy's, you know, wholesaling me the house. So thank goodness we have good buyers who don't really go behind our back and do sketchy stuff. But we literally just send the buyers right to the house. They'll meet with the seller and they'll go take a look. They'll walk the property. They'll let us know what they want to offer. And, you know, we've been doing it so long virtually. It's just like, especially when COVID happened, like we had no choice. So it's just like our new standard of doing business is like, okay, we're not going to physically be there. We're going to send the buyer to the property. Clint, if we have a situation where I think it's going to be a little hairy, where like the sellers and the buyers go in there, maybe usually the seller's like a little sketchy, I'll have one of my friends who I know from back home go there and he'll kind of be like a traffic conductor, you know, and he'll go there. He'll like kind of keep the peace and make sure there's no monkey business going on. But like literally maybe one out of 10 deals will do that, because the other nine, it's never an issue for us. So we've just gotten used to not having to be there and having the proper infrastructure set up with buyers and contractors and obviously contracts, so we don't get snaked to where we can do it virtually. Because me or my acquisitions guy going to that property physically at this point doesn't add a lot of value to the process. Like it doesn't really do anything. Like if I go and show a buyer a house, it's really not going to impact their ability to buy it from me, because they're going to look at the house. The house is what it is. The numbers are just the numbers. So correct. Me going there or even having Brett go there would just be silly at this point. So we've just done it so much and we've gotten so desensitized to it. It's just like our standard way of doing business. And then in terms of doing the flips, like, cause we do some house flips as well. And I do rentals. You know, I have a really good contractor who's like my number one guy who I have a great relationship with. And he knows that I live in Nevada and he knows that, you know, I'm not going to be inspecting these properties. So before he ever gets paid, we do payments in like draw schedules. So he's never ahead of me or whatever. He sends me videos. I look at the videos. I make sure everything is done the right way. If there's changes, I need to have him make changes. And then I pay him electronically. And then we always do this when we're done with the house. I have my real estate agent who's there, walks the property a final time, make sure all the stuff is done correctly. And then we give the contractor his final payment. So between real estate agents, buyers, contractors, and just being around that market for so long, like I've been doing business there for so long, it makes it a lot easier for me to not have to live there. Because if I was starting from scratch and I wanted to go wholesale houses in like Minneapolis, Minnesota, that'd be a lot harder now because I don't have any team or infrastructure. I don't know anyone there. So I'd probably have to go there a few times to really get face-to-face with people to get those relationships off the ground to then over time not have to go there as much. So the fact that we've been there for so long is really the reason why we're, you know, it's so easy to do it virtually, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and that's what I've told people in the past. I mean, we used to wholesale and more than we do now. But what I found is that if you don't have the infrastructure, you haven't built that up and you don't know the area, you have people there that you can rely upon, I thought it was impossible. I mean, you get screwed so many times.
Yeah, it's so hard.
Yeah, it is. And so you got to be realistic about this type of business. So talking about that now, with the market the way it is, you know, we have interest rates that have gone up. You keep hearing in the news that people are just sitting on their properties and they don't want to sell because they can't turn around and buy something else. They've got low interest rate mortgages. Where are you finding these sellers? You know, what's motivating them?
I could talk about this for 4 hours. I love this. Marketing is my favorite, as you could probably tell. So me personally, my favorite way to get deals is through direct mail. And the reason I like direct mail is there's many reasons. The first thing is that you can control who you're sending the message to, right? Like if you're doing Google ads, for example, you're going to target an area and you're going to get people with no equity. You're going to get people, you know, mobile homes that you might not want. You're going to get, you know, whatever listed properties. But with direct mail, I can control that list of people I'm going to send to. So if I'm mailing somebody who's owned their house for 20 years and it's a 3-bed, 2-bath ranch in a certain zip code, when we get calls, we know those calls are coming from that area. So we can control the type of prospects that come into our funnel. And the second thing, and this is why people actually don't like direct mail, is the response rates are so low, right? Like basically, you know, 0.25% is generally the response rate for us. So with the response rates being so low, people get scared because it's expensive and they don't get a lot of calls. But the way that I look at it is if the response rate is that low, when the people actually call to do a deal with you, they're generally really motivated because if they're going all the way through that funnel, most people throw that mail out. The people who actually call are serious because they see the postcard. They're like, oh, wow, I know this guy's buying houses for cash. I'm assuming he's not paying top dollar because it's, you know, it's like the obvious thing. Like, yeah, if you're buying, you know what I mean? So the actual leads we get when they don't disqualify themselves are very motivated. They're almost like pre-vetted. Like, they're like, I know you got to make money. And I just know with direct mail, like if I spend, you know, $5,000 in ads, we're going to generate at least $20,000 worth of revenue. And that's a 4-to-1 return. And then, you know, we just keep doing that over and over again. So for those reasons, I think direct mail is the best, at least for our business. And then the other thing that we will do sometimes is we will do the Google ads. You know, we're going to bid on keywords. People are going to search. They're going to come to our website. They're going to fill out a form. And, you know, those can be pretty good. But a lot of the times those people are actually less motivated than the direct mail people because they're just like trying to get an offer on their house. They're curious, whatever the case is. So our whole business is basically built upon direct mail marketing. And it still works in 2024. People hate it for some reason. They think it's crazy or it's too expensive. But I've just have the data to back up that it works in multiple markets too. This is not just New York. I've done this in San Diego. I've done this in Reno. I've done this in Delaware. So like this channel always works if you work it consistently. Because most of our deals from direct mail, Clint, they don't come off the first thing. Like they get the sixth postcard. And that's another thing too that I didn't mention. Like if you're mailing somebody like so many times, it's just a matter of timing, right? Like the first postcard they get, their tenant's paying rent. But the fifth postcard they get, their tenant hasn't paid rent for 2 months. And then their kind of motivation level's rising because they don't want to have to do an eviction, especially in New York. So they call us on the fifth mailer. Hey, I see you guys want to buy my house. My tenant hasn't paid rent for 2 months. I already know what you guys are about. I've seen your website, whatever. And, you know, it's more of like a warmer lead at that point because you never know when they're going to sell, right? You never know. But if you mail them consistently, it's just a matter of time until somebody on that pool of prospects is going to call in with a problem you can solve.
Okay. So you kind of answered one of my questions then about motivation. So it sounds like that you're targeting people that have investment properties, not necessarily homeowners, but they're landlords. And you're looking to get to take their properties, like you're solving a pain point for them. They're tired of being a landlord. They're tired of having the, you know, the tenants not paying as you just described.
Yeah.
So they're motivated and they want to take their money and put it somewhere else. Is that
correct? That is the big thing. All the rentals I have, I think except for one of them, were tired landlords that I got direct to seller where they had tenants inside. They did. And these are like my personal rentals. Like they didn't want to deal with doing an eviction. The property was beat up. They wanted to get some cash out of that thing and just move it into something else. And I basically bought the property with the problem tenant inside and figured it out afterwards. But I was able to add a lot of value to them because they just didn't want to be bothered with it because they've owned it for so long. They know the eviction process stinks in New York. So, you know, they assign value to that cash offer because of the convenience, right? Like these people are smart people too. They're not like knuckleheads. Like they know they're going to take a discount for convenience. And the fact that I'm willing to buy it with their tenant, because most people in my market don't buy with tenants, but I know, like, I know the risks and I'm, you know, I know how to get them out usually. So like, I have no problem doing that at the right price. Mm-hmm. So when I can make a cash offer and say, yeah, I don't need to see it. And you can keep your tenant inside. You know, that's very appealing to them. Like it's very, very appealing. I had a property, one of my best rentals I have right now. It took me 2 years to evict them, but before I even bought the property, they hadn't paid rent for 2 years. So they were living for free for 4 years. Right. And the guy was like, he couldn't believe that I bought the thing sight unseen with the tenants inside. And I'm like, well, listen, at 125 grand, when it's worth 270, of course I'm going to do that. You know, I didn't tell him that, obviously. But I was just like, yeah, sure. But the tired landlords I've found you can make really good deals with. And another thing too, that, you know, this, I actually did this on another condo I bought 2 months ago, tired landlord, this guy, this is crazy, by the way. This guy's a mortgage broker, super sophisticated guy, makes a ton of money. He owner financed me a condo with a bad tenant that I'm dealing with right now, 0% interest. And he's a mortgage broker because he didn't want to be bothered with the property. I gave him basically market value. I gave him $20,000 down. He took back a 5-year balloon with 0% interest. So the reason I did that deal is because I knew, like, all right, every time I make this guy a payment, I'm paying down principal. There's no interest. And then in 5 years, I'll either cash them out, refi, or sell it, and I'll have all that equity there. And I didn't overpay for the property. I just paid at market value. So, you know, there's a lot of ways you can structure these deals when you have a tired landlord, because usually, you know, they either want to get cash fast, or they just don't want to be bothered with their tenant, and they might not want to pay a huge capital gain situation. So you can owner finance it to them, and then they're going to receive their income over time. But, you know, at the end of the day, I always tell people, this business is just all about solving problems, right? If you can get really good at solving people's problems, especially in, you know, the off market world, you're always going to make money. It's just going to be impacted on your ability to actually solve their problems and see what's going to, you know, be a good fit for their current situation.
You know, I'm going to circle back on when you talked about the postcards that you're dropping, and it takes six you found.
Yeah.
How,
at least.
So how are you spacing those? Is it one a week? Or you send them a new one every other week? Have you found there's a timing there?
So let's say we're doing 10,000 postcards at once. Mm-hmm. I'm going to take, like, for January, for example, we're going to drop 2,500 postcards a week. And that's mailing number one, because then all those prospects have received at least one marketing message. And then I wait 1 week. So there's a space in between. And then the next week after that, so it's really every 5 weeks, those 10,000 people are going to get that same message sent again, 2,500 a week, because I don't want my phone systems getting clogged up with like 10,000 people calling in versus I'd rather space it out on a weekly basis. So every prospect gets a new message every 5 weeks, because I've found that with when you do it in that sequence, you're staying around to where they're not like forgetting about you. But at the same time, you're not like flooding them with a message. Like once a week, they're getting a postcard, because like odds are like on a weekly basis, stuff isn't going to change. But on a monthly basis, there's a better chance of a problem, you know, kind of germinating and getting bigger. Because if you hit them once a week, like they know what's going on. But if you wait every 5 weeks, I've just found that like through tracking our stats to be the most profitable way to do it. I have friends who do every 90 days. I've just found every 5 weeks has generally been what's worked for me in terms of like getting the best ROAs.
But each of those postcards, though, is it different messaging or is it the same message?
So if the one postcard performs good, I keep doing that until the stats get worse. Because if I want to keep doing what's working and not try to reinvent the wheel. So if I use like postcard A, you know, let's say it's like a handwritten postcard or whatever, and that's working well, I'm going to keep mailing that until my stats diminish. Because like, it's funny with direct mail, like people think like you have to have some fancy message and have all this professional lingo on there. Those have always performed the worst for me. The best performing postcards are like handwritten postcards. They're kind of ugly. You know, they stand out in the mail. And we've always just found like that type of marketing message for some reason resonates with the people that we do business with. And like, I used to like be really into like copywriting and Dan Kennedy and all the stuff. And I'd write these sales messages on these postcards and no one would call me. And I was like,
really?
Yeah, like I would write like a whole paragraph and we'd get like literally no phone calls. And then I'd go send out like an ugly postcard that looks like, you know, a sixth grader wrote it. And, you know, I get like all these calls. So I'm just like, you know what? I'm just going to let the market let me know what's working. And I'm going to stop doing this crazy Dan Kennedy marketing crap and just do what works. And, you know, that's what's worked for us. It's like these ugly handwritten postcards from like, you know, any vendor out there, like Yellow Letters HQ or Open Letter Marketing. They all have that product that you can buy from them.
And what do you just say? Hey, I'm interested in buying your property. If you'd like to have a discussion, just give me a phone call.
Yep. I am a cash buyer. I'm looking to buy your house. If you're, you know, thinking about selling, give me a call and we can talk about your options. Like something simple like that. You don't want to make the message too like, you know, like, oh, I can buy your house creatively. I can buy your, like, just, hey, if you're looking to sell your house, give us a call. We can make you a cash offer and, you know, see if it's a fit. And then that way you, because you want the calls to come in. And then at that point you go from marketing to sales, because a lot of people, like I said, they make some crazy postcard up. I can do a wraparound, you know, deed with you. And like, seller doesn't know what that is. And the confused mind always says no. So we just keep it super simple. And the main thing, and this is like a huge takeaway for people if they want to do direct mail, I used to over-track everything. I would over-track all these different weird metrics. The number one thing that matters with direct mail is just the return on ad spend. How much are you making compared to how much are you spending? And if you're a 3-to-1 or higher, which means every dollar you spend, you get 3 back, that's definitely successful. You obviously can do better if you, you know, depending on how your skill set. But that's the only thing that matters with mail. Don't care about response rate. Don't worry about what your cost per lead is. Like, you just want to look at what is the return on ad spend, because that's how you can actually scale that. Because if you know you get a 4-to-1 return on mail, That's the only thing that matters. And that's like any marketing. I mean, you've been in business for super long and done paid advertising. Like return on ad spend is the only thing that really matters, because that's how you know if it's really effective or not, you know?
Nice. So when those calls come in, do you handle all those, or do you have a team?
No, I have a team. So what we do is when those calls come in, it goes to a 24-hour voicemail recording. And it's basically says, hey, thanks for calling. Cause like the way that, like, there's two schools of thought. You could answer the phone live, but most of the people mm-hmm. calling are pissed off. They're like, take me off your list. I don't want to sell, whatever. So like, you're going to kill your sales team's like, you know, mojo with something like that. So what we do is I have someone who works Monday to Friday from like, I think 8 to 7 or whatever. And he's responsible for the new phone calls. So when something goes to voicemail, you know, it triggers a call rail, which is what we use. It's a software system. The seller generally leaves a voicemail. He'll hear the voicemail. If it's a take me off your list, he'll deal with that. But if it's like a real seller, like, because my voicemail says, hey, if you're thinking about selling your property, please leave your name, your best phone number, and the property address, and we'll call you back right away, which is true. We call them back right away if it's, you know, from 8 to 7, Monday to Friday. We'll get right back to them. We'll get all their information first. So like, we like them to leave the voicemail because we want to get their name, their address, and pull the property up, see what's going on. Is it a single family house? Is it a duplex? Whatever. And mm-hmm. then when we call back that seller, we know what's going on. We know their address. We know who we're talking to. And then we can really focus on how do we solve their problem. First of all, do they have a problem we can solve? And then if that is the case, how do we actually solve their problem? So I've found the voicemail system where you send everything to a voicemail to screen it has not dropped our return on ad spend, because we used to hire like a third party call center to answer the phones. And it was just chaos, because like the company would answer the phone, they'd get chewed out, they'd put garbage notes in our CRM. And I'm like, this is super inefficient. I'm like a big systems guy. So I'm like, this is just a broken system. We're going to do what we were doing before. And as long as our return on ad spend is there, that's all that matters at the end of the day. So I actually learned that from a guy who's done like probably 2000 wholesale deals. He like loves the voicemail system. So I'm like, hey, if he's doing it's working, clearly, you know, there's some validity to that system.
So if somebody wants to say they want to get started in wholesaling, or maybe they've started, they're just not finding traction.
Yeah.
As an expert, what would you tell them? What would be your you know, 3 points of things they should focus on right now to help change that?
That's a great question. I hear this a lot. So I would tell them this, and I wish I knew this when I got started, Clint. If you're not having success wholesaling or flipping or doing any sort of off-market endeavor, you have to go back and you need to audit your funnel, which means that if you have not had a lot of success wholesaling, the first question I would ask if I was advising them is I would say, hey, last week, how many offers did you make? And we're going to find a number out. And then the second question I'm going to ask is, hey, last week, how many leads did you generate? And usually when the people who don't have a lot of success answer that question, they say, I don't know, or one. And I'm like, okay, so you haven't had a lot of success wholesaling. You've made one offer, right? You're going to have to make 25 offers at least to get something accepted. So the problem isn't that wholesaling is hard, or the problem isn't you're bad at wholesaling. The problem is you're not focused on the activities that actually move the needle in your business. So I tell every new investor, if you want to be successful, if you can just get in the habit of making one or two offers daily from, you know, generally that's like 2 or 3 leads that come in, and you can just keep those numbers consistent. And every day you get a couple leads, you make a couple offers, and you compound that over, you know, 90 days, if you make 35 or 40 actual off-market offers on people that called in from your marketing, it would be very hard to not buy a house, because it's just a numbers game at that point. But the new people who don't have a lot of success, or the ones who are confused, they don't understand you have to focus on the things that matter. And in this case, if you're going off-market, whether you're wholesaling or flipping or doing the BRRRR, it's leads, offers, contracts, closings, and then whatever exit strategy you're doing. So you got to focus on the things that actually make you money, because a lot of new investors, they'll just watch YouTube videos all day. They'll make their business cards. They'll call real estate agents and deal with listed properties. Like, I have this guy, he's a great guy. I'm not going to mention his name. He hits me up for all these garbage deals that are listed on the market. I'm like, dude, just spend your time marketing to sellers and, you know, cold calling, doing direct mail, and make off market offers, and you'll wholesale me a house. I can guarantee it. I'll pay you a great price. But you're bringing me stuff that's on, because it's easy to go on the MLS and try to lock up a garbage deal and sell it to some knucklehead. It's not easy to go cold call someone and see if they want to sell their house. Like, there's resistance there. So people don't want to deal with the resistance. And then ultimately, that's why they don't have successes, because they don't focus on the things that actually are uncomfortable that generate the money, which is making offers, getting rejected, getting leads, talking to strangers. Like, that stuff's uncomfortable if you're brand new, but it's uncomfortable for a reason, because it actually is what's going to bring you the results.
Yeah. The rejection thing is, I think, what brings a lot of people down. It's like, this is not going to work. No one wants to take my deals. Well, it's kind of like, you know, when you're in college and we'd have a fraternity party, you'd go out and you'd talk to as many girls as you could.
Yeah.
Because finally someone's going to be interested in you. And so just, you know, eventually it'll work.
A broken clock is right twice a day.
Exactly. That's true. So, you know, there's a lot of people out there in the industry that put on classes and teach about wholesaling. What are your thoughts when it comes to the education side of it?
I think there's a lot of good people out there who really have good intentions and integrity. Mm-hmm. I think there are some bad apples out there who just talk out of their butt, quite frankly, and they give the wrong information. So my advice to somebody who wants to follow a guru is, make sure that guru actually has a business that's making money wholesaling and their business is not telling you how to wholesale. That's like step one. And then step two is just study that guru. Don't listen to the other guru. Just focus on one person who's actually successful and study their material versus trying to learn something from XYZ person, then the other person, because they're going to say things that are going to be conflicting most likely. So find someone who's actually doing the business, who has a real wholesaling or flipping business, and they also happen to educate, and just make sure they're legit and then follow their information like to the letter, right? And don't like get shiny object distracted. Oh, well, Steve, the wholesaling guru, said to do this on the MLS. And then Randy said, and I'm just making names up here, Randy said to, you know, do SEO marketing. It's like, no, you're going to go nowhere with that. Like, at the end of the day, if you just make enough offers and get enough leads, you will have success. And I always tell like new investors, like, you know, they'll come to me, they'll hit me up on social, whatever. And I said, listen, the only thing that matters for you right now is doing your first deal to see if you even like this business. So you're not going to be a multimillionaire overnight. You're not going to have 100K in the bank. What do you need to do within the next 6 months to get your first deal done, so you can determine if you actually enjoy this business or not? Because a lot of people, they'll do a deal, they'll make 10 grand, and they'll say, that completely sucked. I don't think I want to do this. And now all of a sudden, they can do something else versus think they're going to be the next, you know, big wholesaler. So you got to really test the business out. You got to go all in. You got to get your first deal. And most likely, you're going to like your first deal. You're going to want to do your next deal. So it's going to probably benefit you. But people just get so, you know, they're like, oh my God, I need my LLCs and I need, you know, to have, you know, my trust set up. It's like, dude, like, you have literally like $500 in the bank. Like, you don't need a trust. Like, you need a trust when you start, you know, getting some wealth, and you don't need business cards. You don't need a website. Like, just focus on making offers. And when you make offers, then you can obviously set up the LLC and buy the property. And like, you can make an offer and then put it in an LLC and then close in the LLC. 100%. Like, you need all to, you know, be there on day one, you know?
Yeah, I know. A lot of people get, like you stated, they get hung up thinking they need to have all the fancy stuff in order to make their business work. And the reality is, that's just an excuse so you don't have to do the work yourself, I find, a lot of times.
100%. It's a fear of rejection. They don't want to get rejected from a seller. They take it. The thing is, too, I know I'm on like a real like high horse here because I'm like so passionate about this, but like people take it personally when they get rejected from a seller. It's like, you have to separate that. Like, you can't ever let a seller impact your emotions when you're trying to buy their house. It's like, if they say no to your offer, they're not saying no to you as a person and your moral compass. Mm-hmm. They're just saying, no, that offer doesn't solve my problem. And when people can get over that hunch of like, oh my God, like, it's not no to me, it's no to my offer, they're just going to make a bunch of offers because they know it has nothing to do with them personally. It has everything to do with their situation and the fact that your solution doesn't solve their problem. But you know what? The good news is, if you do enough marketing, you're going to find somebody who has a problem that you can actually bring a solution to and hopefully make a profit.
Yeah. Well said. And the last thing I would probably put on that too is that, you know, the numbers have to work, and don't chase a deal just because you want to do a deal, because that's where people end up getting hurt.
Yeah. Right. You're a deal finder, not a deal creator, right? You have to find someone with a problem and then solve it versus try to create a problem that's not even there.
That's perfect. Well, hey, if someone wants to get a hold of you, you know, because you have deals and they're interested in it, where would you tell them to go?
Yeah, I would tell them to probably follow me on Instagram. That's probably the best way. And they can kind of see what I'm about and then see, you know, our podcast and stuff we put out. So Grego_37 is my Instagram handle. They can shoot me a follow there, send me a message. Happy to help them out any way I can.
Awesome. I'm going to put that in the show notes as well. Hey, thanks for taking the time. I know I thought this was going to be 30 minutes. We went almost an hour. You deliver great content, and I really appreciate you coming on and sharing that with the viewers.
Thanks, Clint. I appreciate it, man.
All right. Take care, bud.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. Show notes for links to everything mentioned in this episode can be found on our website at andersonadvisors.com/podcast. Be sure you subscribe to our podcast. And if you are already a subscriber, please provide us a review of what you thought of this episode.